Now stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hayes.
Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to Straight Talk on WPVC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Straight Talk is a series of interviews and conversations about legal and social justice issues affecting our community. I am your host, Andre Hanks, and today we will be talking with Dahlia Lithwick, court reporter for Slate. How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for having me, Andre.
Thank you so much for being here. When I asked you originally to come on my show again, it was right in the wake of the Trump grab 'em by the kitty cat video. And so much has happened since then.
And it's all about sex.
It's all about sex. That's right. Maybe that should be the name of the show. It's all about sex. Or maybe not. Some of it's about power. But then maybe sex is about power. I don't know. So Trump does this whole kind of face plant. And things, I remember seeing a graph that showed the, you know, the likely voter, how close they were. And right after that, it kind of started verging off again. And I think it's pretty far right now. But of course, last night there was a breaking news story about the FBI investigation of Clinton's emails again. What's going on with that?
I think this was just misplayed by James Comey, who has tried, I think, really hard. And I have to say, I've had a ton of respect for him, going all the way back to, you know, in the Bush administration. He, I think, is a straight shooter. So I think the notion that he's just in the tank and he's going to do whatever he can to throw the election to Trump is clearly, I think, wrong. Mm-hmm. I think he was trying to find a middle place. He had told in July, he had said, we're closing this investigation, we're moving on. He felt it behooved him, when these new emails surface, to at least report it to Congress.
It sort of sounded like he felt like, since I just told everybody this is closed, now that I have made an affirmative representation about it, since there's a loose end, I feel like I have to say something else.
I think that's right. And you can see this morning, he sent out an internal email that makes this point. He's like, I don't want to freak people out. I don't want to lie. So I'm going to try to give as little information as I can, but just be clear.
Right.
Now, the problem is that the little bit of information raised more questions than it answered. And it was a Rorschach test, right? Trump takes it to mean, holy God, jail is imminent. You know,
right,
these are the most damning criminal, you know, statements. And progressives, I think, take it as this is just about Anthony Weiner tweeting again. So somewhere in the midst of that, he needs to divulge all of it, because what he did actually confounded everyone. We all mapped onto it what we wanted to see.
Right.
But I will say, the reporting I've seen this morning from Kurt Eichenwald at Newsweek and other sources who have, you know, better sources than I, all seem to suggest that these were not Clinton emails. This was from a laptop that Huma Abedin shared with Anthony Weiner. This is not, you know, in the scope of the deleted emails. It's not in the scope of what the investigation was. So it might have just been a great big Oops.
Right. Well, may have been sort of an effort at transparency, which you can't stick your toe in that pool. If you're going to have transparency, you have to dive all the way in. And in that, what I mean is, Comey says, oh, let me be completely transparent about the fact that there's still this one little thing out there, because I don't want anybody to think that I lied, or that, you know, I'm, because I've held this out. And then immediately following that, we get this kind of everybody spins it their way, and there isn't enough information. The Hillary camp, I understand, has sort of called on the FBI to, like, immediately please divulge everything that there is to divulge about this. And it sounds like that's not happening, at least not yet.
It's funny. This is the one moment through this whole campaign of agreement between the Trump campaign and the Clinton campaign. They're both saying divulge all of it.
Shell it out.
I'm sure they're sick at heart about the fact that they're agreeing on anything.
Probably.
But, you know, it is true. It's clear that just sort of saying there may or may not be nothing to see here, folks, James Comey out, is not, you know, enough of a message. And so we'll see. I would just say one other thing apropos of that. This election has been such a lesson in there's no such thing as neutrality anymore, that neutral institutions like the FBI that are trying to be neutral and that actually have institutional obligations to be neutral can't be neutral anymore. And so here's Comey trying really hard, I think, to kind of keep up this longstanding FBI tradition of not inserting himself into the middle of an election, doing exactly that.
I should mention in the context of this conversation that you and I are in the studio on October 29th having this chat, but the power in the studio is partially down, and so what's happening is instead of doing a usual live broadcast, we're actually recording this conversation. So who knows what may happen by the time it gets played on the air.
Right, we're doing this by a flickering fire,
that's
and we're wearing bear skin.
Right, well, I've got a leopard skin, but, you know.
Canned goods, it's bad.
It's serious. Fortunately, we were able to plug in the coffee maker somewhere that we found an outlet that worked. Otherwise, we wouldn't even be able to function.
Which I spilled all over my fur.
But so, you know, by the time we get to airing this broadcast, who knows, the email scandal may have evolved into a whole different thing.
Yeah.
Along with this topic about, you know, the emails and the sort of influences, the way that public perception is so easily influenced, and there's so much social media out there and all of this, I'm thinking a little bit about Julian Assange right now and what's going on with that. I mean, I understand that Mr. Assange is leaking emails, right? And it seems like a pretty deliberate attempt to sway the election. And then over in Russia, we have Putin, and we have this hacking issue going on over there. What do you think about that? What is going on in our world that suddenly these outside influences seem to have so much leverage on what happens here?
Well, one is just a technology problem, right? We are now eminently leakable. And nobody is safe. And I think that's just something, you know, it's a technology. I've been thinking a ton as a Supreme Court watcher about this election and what, you know, just can happen in polling places when everything is computerized and everything is digital. And a huge number of Americans are going to vote on machines that do not give them a paper record.
Right.
So I think we just have one thing is just a huge technology where technology is so far ahead of our other norms and institutions mm-hmm. that this kind of thing is possible. And on the question of Assange, I think it's fascinating, right? I mean, he was a hero to progressives, you know,
right.
with very few exceptions because he was for transparency.
Sure.
Well, he's still for transparency, right? That turns out to be his only political drive. It's not helping progressives.
Right.
It's helping transparency. And so I think in some sense, you know, while we hate him now,
right.
and we think he's, you know, colluding with Putin to make sure that a lunatic wins the election, I think it's important to understand that he actually, in his own unprincipled way, is being perfectly principled. And if you look at this, I think, in the sort of larger context of what you started with, which is just this mistrust, you know, that we really are having trouble trusting anyone and anything right now.
Right.
It, in some sense, makes perfect sense that the sort of harbinger of that, you know, movement is somebody who mistrusts everyone equally. And, you know, you can love him or hate him situationally, but boy, he is sure saying something that I think chimes with what Americans feel, which is those emails, those Hillary emails, that's a crime. You know, that those election places, those are a crime. It's all, you know, everyone's lying to us. And
yep.
there's something to be, in his own dysfunctional way, said for what the project is.
Don't you think we've all known for a very long time that everyone was lying to us, but that somehow having it revealed to us, proven to us in such a concrete way, changes the psychology of it?
It's so interesting. You know, my favorite attack on the Podesta emails is that, you know, the one where it becomes manifest that Hillary Clinton takes one position in private and one in public, mm-hmm. and everyone is horrified by that.
Shocking!
And I was like, wait, didn't Jefferson do that? Like, isn't
right.
that pretty much definitionally what politicians do? And it's so interesting because I think this desire for authenticity is both, you know, deeply felt and understandable, but also kind of cray-cray. Like, it
right.
doesn't make any sense.
Well, and the same thing could be said about the whole Trump videos, right? I mean, Trump takes one position in private in his bus driving down the road with the Bush guy, and then another one in public because he respects women more than anyone.
It's so funny. It's really, you know, what I used to always talk about this with respect to the court, because the Supreme Court doesn't allow cameras in and the justices are just deranged on the subject of privacy.
Mm.
And then they would go out and give speeches and people would sort of record them with a phone and they'd be like, pull that down. And they'd have their, you know,
right.
henchmen pull things
oh,
down.
God.
And I always wanted to say, like, dear justices, there's no privacy anymore. Like, if you're a public figure, whether it's hacked or whether it's an iPhone, the notion that there is sort of a sphere around you that is not penetrable by the media is gone. And that's awful. I mean, I think it's just objectively awful.
That seems to be the case not only with public, that seems to be the case with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do criminal defense, and so I often say to people, you know, if we picked 100 cars driving down the road on Route 29 out in front of the studio, if you had a good cop, he could come up with a legitimate, lawful, would stand up in court reason to stop 99, if not 100 of them. And I think that we've sort of gotten there with data as well, that we are sort of to the point where no matter who you are, there will be something that you said once in an email, once on a post, you know, and that no one is immune to that because no one is entirely consistent. It's inhuman to be entirely consistent.
It's true. And I think that, you know, I always remember, and this is back to my days doing divorce law in Reno, of all places. But, you know, everybody like has a box of porn under their bed. Everybody does, you know, at least all our clients did. And it's just, you know, the way of the world is that you do have one private self and one public self. And once, you know, whether it's the media or legal institutions get a permission, some kind of sanction to get in there and root around, we all look horrible.
Well, yes. I want to go back to something that you brought up, which was about the polling places and the sort of idea that now there are electronic voting machines and there isn't a paper trail. How did that develop over time? Do you have a sense of like when we moved from paper to solely electronic? I mean, I what I'm thinking about is the whole hanging chad business, right? So at that point, at least, there were still places that had an actual physical ballot that was mechanically marked. And I wonder, you know, is this something brand new? Is this...
No, it's new-ish. I mean, it was part, you know, part of the depressing answer is, you know, corporate, because Diebold and other machines, you know, companies that manufactured them came swooping in and said,
here, we'll,
you know,
save you.
My company can solve this problem for only kajillions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And some of those machines were put into place without rigorous testing and without really knowing what the consequence. So I think in trying to correct for the problems of paper ballots, a lot of jurisdictions swarmed to electronic voting thinking this was a cure. And it was a cure that created many new problems.
Many new problems, sure.
And it's also, I think, you know, really important to understand that I think I said this on my podcast that airs on Saturday, but I said that, you know, as Homer Simpson said of beer, you know, the fact that we have such a patchwork of jurisdictions that do different things in this country is both the cause of and the solution to all our problems. Because in America, we have every single jurisdiction does things slightly differently.
Right.
There is no unified system. And that's a disaster in terms of oversight. It's a disaster in terms of, you know, I tried to do a piece about what poll watchers can do legally.
Right, right.
Who knows? Because it differs by state. And that's a problem. It's
right.
A problem not to have unified standards. And it's a problem for voters not to know. But it's also a solution because when, you know, you hear this talk of rigging, and we know that 40-some percent of voters think everything is rigged, it's hard to rig a system that is so atomized,
right,
that it can't be rigged.
If it was all one electronic database,
exactly,
you could create a virus that,
exactly,
made the outcome what you wanted it to be. But because it's so many, 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 many different systems, it's hard to do that.
It's like beer.
It's like beer. Tell me how this is like beer. I'm not really
following.
I want to follow you there.
It's
I do.
My favorite
but...
Homer Simpson quote, and it's applicable to everything. Beer. It's the cause of and solution to all of our problems.
I understand.
And I think that really this very, very fractured patchwork system, it's a disaster, but it's also, it's going to help. In a strange way, it helps. And so you do see machines flipping. I don't want to in any way discount how scary it is when machines flip or when you don't have a paper record. But hacking into entire, you know, then that's the fear, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen hacking into registration databases. I mean, this is a non-trivial fear.
Mm-hmm.
But to do it on a scope that can swing a presidential election,
right,
is absolutely beyond the capacity of even the like Maxwell Smart chaos world of, you know, it's just beyond any bad guy.
I hear you. You know, I'm thinking about the hanging chads. I'm thinking about Nader. I'm thinking about whether or not we may find our election the result of litigation. I don't think this is going to be a close case this time, but there could be other reasons that something ends up going before the court. And then, of course, tied into this, all these systems are interrelated, is the problem that we don't have nine justices now. So talk to me a little bit about what's going on with the fact that we've got an open seat on the Supreme Court for how many days now?
I'm glad you asked.
Yes, tell me.
Today marks 227 days since Merrick Garland's name was announced in the Rose Garden.
Okay.
And we've had an open seat since February 13th of 2016. And I should just say, in case you like trivia, that that previous record holder was Louis Brandeis. That was 100 years ago. He waited 125 days for a hearing, which Garland surpassed in July. So we are in uncharted domain. And you know, it's not just, I think the easy evidence that it's bad is that we had four decisions in four cases last year, including two incredibly consequential cases where there's now no decision.
Can you relay those for our listeners?
The three,
and for me, acting as though I know what they are?
No. The three really important one was had to do with jurisdiction of non-tribe members on tribal land. It's a question that desperately needs resolution, didn't get resolved. The other one was the public sector unions case that I think we talked about last time
I was on the show.
And that was literally this question of how are we going to fund public sector unions? And if the court had voted with Scalia on the court, I think we would have seen the demise of public sector unions in this country. And the third and absolutely most imperative one was Obama's executive order on immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And this one gets stayed, right, by one district court judge in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
The Fifth Circuit upholds the stay. And because the court split, that executive action, which would have given millions of folks in this country who are here illegally but have been here for a long time, it would have given them at least some coherent legal status,
mm-hmm.
is now in doubt. That's been stayed. It will not get resolved. In fact, the court refused to take it again this term.
So do you think they refuse to take it because they know it would be a 4-4 split and so there wouldn't be any judgment? So why spend your time on it?
The court's docket this year, I mean, if you're an IP lawyer, if you're an intellectual property, it is like the best docket in the world. But if you care about like big constitutional issues, they batted everything away because they can't take. And I would just say one other data point that's worth thinking about is that the court granted three huge cases again for this year, including a massive religious liberty case that they won't calendar. So this was a case that's supposed to be on the December calendar, and they won't put it on because they know it's going to be 4-4. So I think you're looking at a court that not only deadlocked in several cases last year, and that's not even to then dig down deeper in the cases that were unanimous that achieved nothing, right?
Mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm.
was Zubik, the Hobby Lobby 2.0.
Right.
The court was like, oh, no, we achieved perfect unanimity when we decided nothing in that case.
Right.
So, you know, this is a court that's not doing what it's meant to do. And not taking cases this year and not docketing cases it's already taken. Oh, and parties are now like withdrawing cases from the court. So we have a huge gun case that would have come up from the Second Circuit. And the parties were like, no, we're good.
We
don't need to take. So really, I mean, how dysfunctional does it need to be? And you know, I think this week I will just end by saying, you know, last week John McCain said, oh, we're never, even if, you know, Hillary wins, we're not gonna clear any of her judges ever. Ted Cruz doubled down on that this week in Texas. So we're really seeing, I think, obstruction raised to sort of performance art and absolutely no grasp of the consequences. And so your, you know, fundamental question is what happens when we get a Bush v. Gore?
Right.
And we have a 4-4 court. And my answer is like, this is why I like wake up with night sweats.
Wow.
Sorry,
beer,
America.
Beer is the answer.
Beer and the solution and the cause.
So you said there were three cases that they had taken up that were very significant this term. And one of them was a religious liberty case. What are the other two?
One of them had to do with collective bargaining. And one of them I actually can't remember offhand, but these were all cases that have been sort of burgeoning in the pipeline and that are resolving, you know, major circuit splits. Now, the surprise was that yesterday, or if this isn't Saturday, then on Friday, the court did grant a case that we all thought it needed to take, and that was the North Carolina, Virginia transgender bathrooms cases that came up from the Fourth Circuit.
Yeah, that's talk a little bit about that case. That's a crazy situation.
Well, it's first of all, I mean, I think this is exactly why you need a court of nine people, mm-hmm. because this is at the most personal level going to preclude a high school senior this year from getting relief, right? I mean, this won't get relief, so to speak. Wow.
Nice.
Andre
very nice.
Spat out coffee. Nice. Over the campfire. But this is, you know what I mean? Insofar as justice delayed is justice denied, you have a plaintiff in this case who deserves to have an answer. And clearly now this is not going
to
get resolved.
He deserves to use the bathroom.
He deserves to use the bathroom, and he deserves to have a court hear his case. So that's, I mean,
where a high school student can pee is now
student.
A subject of debate for the highest court in the land.
Well,
who may be incapable of deciding it because there aren't nine of them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it seems, I know it's possible to say, like, this is, and I know he said yesterday that New York Times, like, I can't believe where I pee is becoming a matter for the highest court in the land. But if you think about it, this was, right, this derives from the Obama administration more or less issuing an executive, it wasn't an executive order, it was just an executive statement saying schools that get Title IX funding need to allow students to go to the bathroom that conforms with their gender identity. This actually was not a new policy. This is a policy that they've had for years. This shouldn't have been a surprise to anyone. There was no threat to take away federal funds. But what we saw in North Carolina and Texas and other states was just an explosion of all students will go to the bathroom, you know, that conforms with what the gender that they were born. And that turned into, you know, a lawsuit. It surprisingly went up to the Fourth Circuit. Surprisingly, the student in Virginia prevailed in the lawsuit. And that shouldn't be, you know, a matter that the court can't resolve.
I hear you. We are going to take a break here, and we'll be right back in just a minute with Delia Lithwick. So you are listening to Straight Talk, and my guest today is Delia Lithwick, courts reporter for Slate. And we were just discussing where high school students can pee. So didn't Gavin Grimm end up one of Time Magazine's Teens of the Year? Isn't that sort of how that went recently? I think it did.
Yeah.
And it's kind of amazing that issue of, you know, raising your hand and may I go to the bathroom becomes, you know, Time Magazine material, too.
Well, I think he really suffered. I mean, I think if you look at, you know, this suit, this is a kid who, by virtue of being initially allowed to go to the boys' bathroom, then told he had to go to the girls' bathroom. Then girls were reporting that they were terrified that he was in the girls' bathroom. And then he was told he had to, like, haul himself through school and find, you know, a single bathroom.
Special bathroom?
It was really traumatic. And I think, you know, I think it's really, it's important to sort of understand that, you know, for a kid of this age to come forward and sort of be the face of this is pretty brave. I don't know that, you know, my teen kids could
really
do this.
Brave.
So again, you know, I think it's very of a piece with some of the stuff we saw in Obergefell, where there's this construction of a narrative that is like children aren't safe.
Oh, right.
A transgender, you know, that this is, you know, they're going to be assaulted in their bathrooms and all the sort of magical thinking that is so crazy around where we pee. And so that's,
right.
You know, what we're having to answer to. And it's a very, very strange litigation. You're right. At one level, like, it's crazy. But I think it is having real impacts on, you know, teenagers in this country who are trying to kind of get clear about who they are and how they want to hold themselves out, and, you know, who and schools that kind of really just feel like they want to help their students.
Why do you think the court granted cert in that case? I mean, we got an 8-person Supreme Court, and they're refusing to grant cert in a number of other issues. And some that they're granting cert on, they're refusing to docket. Why did they grant cert in this case?
It's a great question. And I think you also need the backdrop of when this case comes up for an emergency stay in August, the court actually stays it, right? And that's because Stephen Breyer, who typically votes with the liberal bloc, voted with the conservatives to stay this. So I think that was a really big surprise to a lot of people. And it's just been an interesting sort of, those of us who spend the summer thinking about things like this, we're really trying to understand what Breyer was trying to do by saying, you know, we're not going to change the status quo until we hear this case. And there's a lot of interesting explanations for why he did
that. Maybe he was being principled.
Well, you know, I think there used to be a courtesy.
That would be shocking, wouldn't it?
You remember there was a courtesy stay at the Supreme Court where if you had four votes, and I think that starts with Lewis Powell.
Right.
I'm going to be the fifth vote because this is so
split, and there's some interest in our society in maintaining stability, so we are going to maintain the status quo until.
That's what he was doing, I think.
I
don't think he was siding against transgender bathroom, you know, principles. I think he was saying when it's this riven, let's be for caution, which just parenthetically may explain why. Well, all the other justices are out saying it's really suckish to have eight on the court. Steve Breyer takes to MSNBC this week to be like, eight is enough. It's awesome.
No.
It's great. It doesn't bother us at all. Like, I think he's just such an institutionalist that he thinks in those terms. And literally when Ted Cruz said, we're not going to confirm any Hillary judges, he cites Breyer. No problem here. We could do this with eight.
Oh,
we could do it with two. We could do it when it's Elena Kagan under her desk flipping a coin. Like, we don't need nine justices. So thank you, Justice Breyer.
I would
Breyer.
Go for Elena Kagan.
I would under her desk flipping coins. So now I'm completely not even remembering what the question is. Why did they grant? I think they granted because there's no harm to granting, because even if they split 4-4 and the Fourth Circuit is upheld, there's no national, right? Nothing changes nationally. And I think that this was such a contentious case, and that it's really probably one that's bothering the justices, that they had to grant. Now, that said, we don't know where the justices are on this issue. I think it's not just because Anthony Kennedy sided with the liberal wing of the court in Obergefell in the gay marriage case doesn't necessarily mean
marriage is different than peeing.
I don't know that they have Justice Kennedy. So, you know, who really knows what's happening? And they may also, this is my last thought on this, they may think that they're going to have a ninth justice by the time this case is heard in March or April.
Do you think they might have a ninth justice by the time this case is heard in March or April?
Call your bookie.
Right. Get out the crystal ball, right?
I think that there is a non-trivial possibility that moderate Republicans in the Senate, if they lose the Senate and if Hillary Clinton is elected, and that's what polls seem to suggest is going to happen, people like Jeff Flake and even Chuck Grassley, who have staked their reputation on, okay, we said the next president decides, are going to have a huge incentive to do a lame duck hearing for Merrick Garland, who is 64.
Right.
Who is absolutely, I think, to the right of Steve Breyer and, you know, moderate left, but focus on the moderate, and who they were all praising. Right. 5 years ago, Orrin Hatch was saying, oh, we would love Merrick Garland. You know, we want him more than Elena Kagan. I think that they know that if Hillary Clinton withdraws Merrick Garland's name and puts someone up, that person is going to be 26.
Well, I think, I mean, the isn't that a little like accepting the plea agreement after the verdict has come in? I mean, you know, I think once you lose the election, you know, why wouldn't Hillary Clinton withdraw Garland?
Well, so that's the question. I mean, that's the question that we've all, you know, on this beat been trying to report out. And I will tell you, she's playing us. She's playing us like fiddles, because you'll remember in the second debate, she said, what kind of justice would I want? I would want a Washington outsider.
No.
I would want someone who has no judicial experience. And we were all like, red alert, she's pulling Garland.
Right.
And then in the third debate, just when we thought we were reading the tea leaves, she said, of course Merrick Garland needs a hearing. This is, you know, of course. And so she's clearly, it's in her interest to say, I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do. And that's how she's been playing.
She's going to keep us in suspense.
Well, because
like,
she wants,
like Donald.
I think she wants the Jeff Flakes of the party to realize that the consequences for the GOP and for the court, if you replace Scalia with somebody literally 45 years old who has a long progressive record, that's the ball
game. That's the court.
That's it. And, you know, the other thing that Bear's saying...
But I still want that to be the ball game.
I know. I know. I mean, it's really, you know, you can understand why, you know, Ted Cruz is standing there and saying, like, we are going to stop every nominee she puts forward.
Do you think they'll have the ability to stop her nominee? Do you think they're going to hold on to enough of the Senate to block her?
I think that the first thing that's going to happen, and we heard this yesterday from Tim Kaine, and we heard it... I think we're starting to get Harry Reid is saying they're going to kill the filibuster rule. So if the Democrats take the Senate, you know, that they always had, even though they did away with the filibuster for the circuit courts and the district courts, the Supreme Court was special. It had to be 60 votes.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be gone. And Tim Kaine has said as much yesterday. It's like, if we take the Senate, we are going to confirm.
Man, that is a dangerous
yep.
thing to do.
Yep.
I understand why it has short-term utility, but it is a terribly dangerous thing to do.
I think that the impetus behind it is simply there have been no consequences.
We are so fractured we can't
227
move.
Days without a nominee and the promise of four more years, we're done. And this is where I just think it's so important, Andre, to realize, like, this is not a law, it is not a rule, you know,
it's an internal procedure.
It is a norm
of the Senate
that has been honored in this country for 200 years. And once norms are broken, there's no... And I think the coda to that, I mean, I'm interested in your thoughts on this, but the coda is, I think Obama thought there would be consequences when he put up Merrick Garland, you know, a perfectly centrist compromise candidate, and folks obstructed. And we haven't seen consequences, not in the Senate races, maybe...
Well, if shutting the federal government down didn't create those consequences, I think the sort of esoteric, you know, far removed from the daily life of your average American issue of whether or not you're going to approve a particular Supreme Court nominee is probably pales in comparison to you're not getting paid this week.
I think that's right. Although, you know, I keep going back to FDR and the court packing plan and how, you know, the pushback came from the American people.
Oh, man,
right?
That was an entirely different time, though.
Yeah, because norms mattered, right?
Norms mattered, and There was a feeling, I think, of good faith that existed in the public, and I don't think that exists anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we don't believe that journalists can cover things in a neutral way, and maybe they can't.
Right.
It's sort of like what you were saying about Comey trying to be neutral and that it's impossible to be neutral anymore. But it seems like that's, you know, that's the danger. Our institutions, our government, you know, we have these foundational documents. We have a constitution. It puts together a balance of power. But in the end, all of that can be destroyed by the sort of gamesmanship that lawyers like me have been practicing for the last couple hundred years. And I think that level of gamesmanship, you know, it hasn't happened historically because people have had some level of, okay, this is how far I will go with this. And I will not... You know, I will fight this battle up to here, and then I will say, okay, well, you know, I respect the system, and the buck stops here, and if I lose, I lose. And I think that as a society, we have lost that barrier in ourselves.
I love what you're saying, because it dovetails so perfectly with what I've been thinking this week, which is... You know, once you have Ted Cruz literally saying we can have a Supreme Court with much fewer people, and, you know, Mike Lee saying, you know, we're just not going to confirm anyone, and John McCain. And I've been sort of saying, and then, you know, the justices themselves fanning out. And, you know, on the one hand, you have Sotomayor saying eight isn't working, and Kagan saying, you know, we need a ninth justice. This is, and then you have Breyer on the other hand saying, it's awesome here. We love it. And, you know, I've been saying all week that it's time for the Chief Justice institutionally to speak up, and that, you know, the only thing that protects the court has no army, it has no Navy, it has no Marines. You know, what it has is public respect.
It has the respect of the American people.
And that's it. And they've been trying so hard to be above the fray. And, you know, it's exactly what you're saying, that in an effort to be neutral, in an effort to say we are not going to make ourselves an issue in this election, there is no neutral anymore.
Right.
There is no neutral. And so what you're doing is sort of feeding into the very nihilism that you're describing. You know, you're saying, by saying nothing, what the Chief Justice is saying is, you can go ahead and kneecap the court, because it's better than me speaking about the effects of kneecapping the court. And that's an amazing place to be at institutionally. And I don't think for a moment, by the way, that the Chief Justice is going to stand up and say, you know, please, please, like, we're dying in here.
Right.
You know, like, better to turn off the lights than to do it this way.
Right.
But I do think that absent someone doing that, the institution that's trying to look nonpartisan is actually fueling the partisanship.
I'm remembering back to deep, deep in my law school experiences and learning that we learned that the early Supreme Court would almost always decide things unanimously. Right. And that what would happen is it's not that there wouldn't be disagreement among the justices. They would disagree, but they would disagree in that little room together and hammer it out, and they would come to a decision, and then they would announce it in a unified voice. And that is gone, daddy, gone, which is, you know, at the time when I was a law student, I remember thinking, well, why did they do that?
Right.
Now, sitting here kind of watching what's happening in the news, I think I understand why they did that.
And the great thing about that, I'm so glad you mentioned that, is that comes about because John Marshall, right, the legendary Chief Justice John Marshall, who becomes the one who consolidates the court's power and makes it a co-equal branch, he had all the justices living in this crappy little boarding house in D.C. They all lived together. And that's not because they were, like, weird. They were weird. But it was because they were all riding circuits, right? They all mm-hmm. spent half their life getting on horrible, you know, horse-drawn carriages and going to their circuits and deciding cases there. And so they weren't in D.C. that much. And when they were together, they were in a boarding house. And he literally would just start pouring wine. And they were collegial. And like you say, they worked it out because they lived together.
Sure.
And I think if you map that against, you know, what you hear like Norm Ornstein saying about how, you know, congressmen and senators used to live in D.C. Their kids played soccer together. They had relationships. There were repeat players. And that as soon as it became okay to leave D.C. and to have your family be at home, there was no incentive to cross the aisle.
Well, that's what I love about practicing law in Charlottesville is that our bar mostly gets along with each other. Prosecutors and defense attorneys, kids go to school together, and we do have a beer together, and we do, you know, and it's a very collegial community for the most part. And you have the sense that most of the attorneys across the aisle from you have some ethics, and even if you disagree strongly with them and you're fighting them tooth and nail, both of you have sort of you still have that bar. You still have that place where you will not go beyond this. And I think that our clients or our complaining witnesses on the prosecution side are both expecting more and more that we will not have such barriers.
Right.
I have conversations with clients in my office where the client, you know, tells me, okay, well, this is what I'm going to say. And it's different than what they told me
right.
When we first met about what happened. And then I say, no, you're not. That is not with me as your lawyer. That will not be what we do. And that's a hard thing to do, right? Because that client's paying me. And in their opinion, you know, why wouldn't we do what we need to do to win? Well, because that's just not how it works. And I think that we're lucky here in this little legal community that we exist in that I think most people are still behaving in that ethical way. I think that the stakes have gotten too high in the national political levels for people to really hold that line very much.
And don't you think, I mean, this is where I just think I'm so grateful to have come up through a legal tradition and not a political tradition, because I feel like even at the Supreme Court, in addition to what you're describing, which is a collegial bar of repeat players who can't afford to burn each other because they're going to see each other next week. But in addition to that, I think that the benchmark that is the law makes it different. Because, you know, if you look at political discourse, now we have two bubbles, right?
Right.
And my truth is not your truth. And Hillary and Benghazi and the emails and she's a liar and she should be in jail.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, on the other hand, you know, well, it's hard to say. Donald
right.
Trump is kind of a, you know, horrible nihilist woman grabber. But let's pretend that that latter thing is not true. But, you know, I think that for me, the sort of organizing principle of legal discourse is that you just don't get to lie, or there are consequences for lying. And I know people lie all the time. But for me, what helps is that there's an agreed upon fact-finding mechanism and agreed upon facts. And it's one of the very few places now that I can see in sort of public life where, and here I'm thinking about, you know, the two developments just in my, you know, field, where in the abortion cases now, you can't just assert that these clinic regulations are for women's health, mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. the court has said, no, there are facts. And if these don't help women's health, then we are going to pierce, you know, the legislative claims about that. And we're going to look at them. And the same is true in the vote suppression cases, right? Where we've seen court after court this year say, don't tell me that you're doing this to, you know, make sure there's right. no voter fraud. You're doing this to suppress the African-American vote. And I think that the law still has the capacity to do that. Maybe that's not scalable, but I think, like, for me, honest to God, it's the only thing that keeps me sane is that ours is kind of a profession.
That and beer.
That and beer cause a solution, too. But I do think that that makes the law different. In other words, I think I'm saying not only are lawyers different, but I think the law gives you a sort of basement beyond which it's very, very hard to, you know, continue to live in two worlds.
If the fate of our country, if the lawyers are the bulwark against the, you know, dissension into chaos, then we are in deep, deep trouble. that, you know, well,
you go, Ted Cruz.
the other thing that I think happens that makes these legal cases, particularly these cases that rise to the level of the Supreme Court, very difficult, is that politics and law, while they're separate bubbles, aren't separate bubbles at all, and they're bleeding over into each other all the time. And so there are, and that's where I think juries get interesting, right? You know, because we have judges, our lawyers, right? You know, and we have this legal system, and we, you know, it can be sort of, it cannot always make sense to us emotionally, but it makes logical sense, right? And sort of over the grand scheme of things, over the run of thousands and thousands and thousands of cases, you know, we develop something that makes some logical sense, and then in most cases will produce the right result. But in any given case, it may or may not produce the right result, and you have little air quotes there, based on how we feel about it as human beings, which is part of why we have a right to a jury trial, right? Well, what is the right to a jury trial really about? It's really about there are two things it's about. One, it's about judges can become jaded. They might be removed from the realities of life in some ways. And we feel like juries can make a different sort of determination of fact, right? They can assess the credibility of a witness within the social context that exists on the ground for most of us. They are not up there in the ivory tower with the sort of big view. And we think there's value to that, particularly in fact finding. That's why juries make decisions about what the facts are. But there is also this sense that as the political split spreads, as we live in two different Americas, our jurors are also becoming mm-hmm. polarized in that way, too. And so I wonder if over time we'll have a lot of mistrials because we'll have so many people who can't even speak to each other if this continues, that we won't be able to get a verdict because, you know, the red people can't talk to the blue people.
Here's my sad answer to that question. My sad answer is I think that because geography is so determinative of those bubbles, that in some sense, you don't have to worry about split juries because geography more and more is going to make sure that we have red juries and blue juries. Oh. And that's even worse than your mistrial scenario.
It sort of means you can't, you lose your ability to move within the country. You
right.
lose your
right.
ability, your right to go across lines. It sort of makes me think about the, you know, the 60s and the public accommodations cases
right, right.
and the idea that somehow as an American you had a right to go outside of your little hometown
yeah.
to other places in the country.
Yeah.
And that right may be limited in this additional way. That's crazy. All right. Well, this is one of those moments where I go, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Straight Talk. My guest today is Dahlia Lithwick, courts reporter for Slate Magazine, and we are just having a fabulous time here, even though we have coffee and not beer. So let's talk for a minute. You mentioned Title IX in one of your earlier responses to a question, and I think it was about the trans bathroom case and this sort of idea that what happened was the Obama administration issued something that said, hey, you know, if you get funds from Title IX, then you have to let people pee where they want to pee. And I'm sure they said it in much more, prettier language than that. But that's what it says.
That's the executive summary.
And I do lots and lots of sexual assault cases. Now, I'm a criminal defense attorney, right? So I'm defending people who are charged. And the Obama administration did sort of the same thing through the Office of Civil Rights. At some point, they issued a guidance document, and the guidance document said, hey, colleges and universities, you're handling sexual assault cases wrong. We want you to use this different standard, and we want you to do all these different things. And what it seems to me is happening is there is an effort to make a culture shift. Right. There is a deliberate effort on the part of the Obama administration, on the part of feminists, on the part of liberals to change the culture, not only on college campuses, but I think it's broader than that. But that's where you can get your teeth in right now. And there's sort of an idea that we live in a society that has rape culture and that we are going to change that. I'm in an odd place as a liberal feminist lesbian who then defends people who are accused of these things. So it gives me a very different perspective on it. But it's an interesting place to be. And it's interesting to hear that Title IX is now kind of, you know, in the Gavin Grimm case as well. It ties into a bunch of things. And when we began the show, we said, well, this show is kind of about sex, right? You know, it starts with the Trump kind of grab him by the meow kind of quote, right? You know, and then right now, also, in addition to that, we've been talking about the Supreme Court, we have this potential for there to be problems with Clarence Thomas. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on with the Thomas accusations right now?
I have to say, I'm just gobsmacked because this, you know, the story lands on Thursday morning. Marcia Coyle, who is one of the most, I would say, sober, meticulous reporters on my beat, does this extensively researched story where she finds someone who had, you know, in the wake of the Donald Trump, Billy Bush video, mm-hmm. when all of us were posting on Facebook,
right.
this is what my TA did, and this is what, you know,
right.
I was eight, and it was my
right.
dentist.
Yes,
a woman,
the Twitter feed, all the rape
all
Twitters.
Which is amazing, right? Which is a way to talk about,
right.
you know, many of the women who posted, at least on my Facebook page, Andre, mm-hmm. had never told anyone.
Right.
Had never told anyone. And so this was an extraordinary moment. And I, you know, credit where it's due. If think for one second about the fact that 25 years ago, 2 weeks ago, 25 years ago, Anita Hill sat up there in front of an all-male Senate Judiciary Committee and they treated her like she was a lunatic, right? So things have changed.
Right, right.
And it's important to credit that. And partly, I think, because women are coming forward now. Anita Hill, women came forward because they sent her mail. And
right.
it took 2 years.
Right.
So this happens in 72 hours. We have this, I think, landmark moment for women where women are all coming forward and saying, and yes, it
that
was me,
is
and
enough.
It was me, and it was me.
Right.
So one woman comes forward and says, in 1999, I had a fellowship in D.C. Clarence Thomas was already on the court. Oh, and he grabbed my rear at an event and made me incredibly uncomfortable. Now, Marcia Coyle not only gets a hold of this Facebook post, which has since been taken down, but she also finds the four contemporaneous witnesses, all the housemates of this young woman,
mm-hmm.
who's now an attorney. And they all say, yeah, it happened.
Yeah, that
we
happened.
Sat in our kitchen table and she cried. And the reason I'm saying it's extraordinary is because Marcia puts the story out there. And it
right.
sort of gets tweeted and then silence.
Right.
It doesn't break through the noise. It's not the Billy Bush video. In fact, by yesterday, it had almost disappeared. And so for me, I just think two reflections, and I'm very curious what you think. One reflection is, well, it's Clarence Thomas, right? A, he has lifetime tenure. B, we litigated this 25 years and 2 weeks ago. He, you know, we all sort of, those of us who really followed the reporting after the trial, after the Clarence Thomas' testimony, all sort of suspected that it was true of him. And so there's nothing left to say. But I think the other thing that happened, and this is just an indictment of me and the rest of the Supreme Court press corps, is we don't do dirty secrets. You know, we do footnotes. That's what we do. And we're very uncomfortable reporting on, you know, the personal lives of the justices. We're very uncomfortable. This is not our story. We're right. hoping that the political reporters take it. And I think this fell into a hole between, you know, Donald Trump, that's a story, and Clarence Thomas somehow is not a story.
Not the story.
And I should say, just for clarity, he issued a denial. He says this absolutely didn't happen. And we moved on. And
how
that's
do you prove,
fascinating.
You know, 25 years later, whether or not somebody grabbed somebody's butt. I mean, that's, you know, that's just tough.
Well, but that goes to your Title IX question, right?
Yes, it
These
does.
Are he says, she says. I mean, at the end of the day,
it goes to it, but it doesn't, because a lot of those cases are more recent. I mean, you're trying to try something 25 years ago. If you're trying to try a homicide, I tried a homicide once that was 20 years old, right? Well, there was still evidence, right? There was evidence there, and we could look at it, and we could talk about it, and we could inspect it, and we could test it. And, you know, there was physical evidence, right? And there were lots of police photos of the scene and the dead body. And I mean, you know, there was something there to work with. When you're talking about he grabbed my butt, what do you got?
Yeah. Nope,
you got you know what word. You got? You know, the best thing you got is the housemate sitting there saying she cried.
Yeah. No, you've got her. But that's Anita Hill, right? I mean, that's Anita Hill, which is also years and years later.
Right. But then at the same time, we're sitting here looking at the Rolling Stone case, right? And here's this woman who says, I was gang raped. And, you know, this horrible thing happened and lots and lots of detail and it's a lie.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's a problem. And it goes to, I mean, the reason I say it goes back to your Title IX problem is that these are unique cases. These aren't homicides. There aren't fingerprints. You know, there's very rarely, you know, heaps and heaps of evidence. And
right.
then you get into this, who do you believe question? And that was at the core of Anita Hill. Who do
how
I like
do we,
better?
How do we know if justice, the allegation against Justice Thomas is a Jackie claim or a real claim? I mean, the fact that it arises in the context of this sudden sort of cathartic feminist revealing of sexual assault kind of cuts both ways.
Right, right. I mean, I think that it cuts both ways, and it also raises the stake for other women who want to report, right?
Right.
So within an hour of this woman coming forward, we have the National Review Online just trashing her, you know, in its pages mm-hmm. and suggesting that she's not a credible witness. Why? Because she's a Democrat.
Oh, right.
And she's given money to Democrats.
Right.
So you can see how, I mean, I could imagine the chilling effect on anyone in these cases. And at the same time, you know, if this isn't true and if Anita Hill's claims weren't true, you know, Clarence Thomas has spent 25 years being tarnished by these claims.
Well, that cuts both ways, too. I mean, there's a chilling effect because the National Review is going to say bad stuff about you. But there's also an incentive,
right.
a bonus, because liberal media is going to say good things about you
right.
and you're going to be a hero to the feminists. And so, I think all of that, it's difficult to interpret which way that goes.
It is difficult to interpret. And I think it's clearly the case that, you know, some women lie. And it's clearly the case that, you know, some men are assaulters. And, you know, the data certainly suggests that fewer women lie than, you know, than we hear. And mm-hmm. more men are assaulters than there are women lying. So I think there's a slight, you know, you have to sort of slightly look at it through the lens. But I agree with you. You know, the notion that we just believe all women, which has been the, you know, strong feminist position on this, can't be correct. You know, that all men are casual rapists, that can't be accurate. But I think that we do have to see it through this, you know, millennia of how men have treated women. And we do have to give some credence to the reports. But I think at the end of the day, if you're saying as a sort of a mechanism, what is the mechanism, whether it's Title IX or whether it's the legal system or whether it's counselors reporting, you know, in lieu of, we don't have a great mechanism for testing the veracity of these claims. We simply don't. And then I think everybody gets clobbered. I mean, it just seems to me that if the Rolling Stones, you know, case stands for anything, it's for the proposition that everyone lost, absolutely everyone.
And then you have judges who are supposed to decide these cases, right? And the judges, the judiciary is supposed to be sort of above the fray.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you get to be a judge, right? You get to be a judge because you're appointed. You're appointed by the legislature, which is elected, at least in this state. Some states, it's even more direct. The judges are elected,
the judges,
right?
Most states, yeah.
So, you know, if you say, I don't believe this woman, who says she was raped right now, you know, you are endangering yourself. If you say, I do believe this woman, at the moment you're in an okay position, but what happened to beyond a reasonable doubt if we're talking about a butt grab 20 years ago? So what ends up happening is these cases get taken to juries. And then it just depends on, you know, red state, jury, blue state, yeah. Or, you know, who your jurors are.
And I would add to that, just because I've been thinking about this a lot in the context of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and, you know, her legacy at the court, that, you know, the data shows, and I think this is fascinating, that when there were only two women at the U.S. Supreme Court, when it was O'Connor and Ginsburg in that chunk of time, they agreed about 50% of the time on almost all cases. On gender cases where women were, you know, the victims of something, they agreed over 90% of the time. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a fascinating proposition that women are, you know, acutely sensitive to this or uniquely sensitive, regardless of, you know, political ideology. We're certainly seeing that in the Trump campaign where women are pulling away regardless of their politics. But I think there's a complicating, confounding factor here, which is that some women really think, you know, there's a woman's point of view on this that's different from a men's point of view. So it's not just red state, blue state. It's,
right.
You know, this happened to me, therefore it happens to everyone. That is also confounding this very much.
Well, I think the point of view should be there is evidence or there isn't evidence. But the evidence includes the testimony. So mm-hmm. That's the problem there. And then it all just comes down to sort of a credibility issue, and there's no good way to judge credibility.
No, you end up looking at Clarence Thomas and looking at Anita Hill and picking the one that you like better, and that's clearly not the way the justice system was meant to work.
No, but that is how it often ends up working.
Sure.
So one of the things that you also talked about a little earlier was about the press coverage of Trump versus Clarence Thomas, and this sort of idea that Trump is news and Clarence Thomas isn't news. I have been following over the last month or so what is going on with the Dakota Access Pipeline. And when I first started following it, I found out about it on Facebook, right? There was zero coverage of it anywhere. And even now, there's very little coverage of it. Whereas there's a ton of coverage about the Bundy brothers and the wildlife refuge situation out there, which, although I think those two situations, the equation that's being drawn right now on Facebook is this idea that the Bundy guys got off and look at what terrible things are happening to the Dakota Access Pipeline protesters. Therefore, see, we don't have equal justice.
Hashtag white privilege.
Right. Sure. But sort of what I see in those things, in addition to sort of uneven press coverage, because there is very uneven press coverage there, I think, is that the Dakota Brothers case is at the post-trial point, right? We're not looking now at what happened at the moment that they were arrested, and we're comparing that post-trial, here's a verdict, point to the moment of arrest with the Dakota Access Pipeline. And I think that those are sort of apples and oranges in some ways.
That's such a good point, and I think we forget that, you know, it's one of the reasons I no longer go on CNN the day somebody is arrested.
Right.
Because all you can do is speculate about what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And I find that to be almost invariably when I do it, I'm wrong.
Right.
So I think that you're exactly right to say that you can't equate, you know, a judicial determination of guilt with the fact that somebody got arrested, you know, that there was probable cause or that somebody got arrested. So you're quite right. They're totally different stages. And I do think that they, you know, your larger point is that we're so quick to draw equivalencies now, and that's sort of become, you know, the sort of fashionable way of, you know, all X get treated this way, all Y get treated this way. It doesn't matter what system you're in or what point in the system you're in. Mm-hmm. It's just a very, very easy, you know, sort of trick. And it usually, I think, obscures more than it clarifies.
Well, we've kind of degenerated down to this kind of third grade, it's not fair,
right,
kind of level of debate. And that's because it's a lot easier to put up a couple of pictures and go, this is not fair,
right,
than it is to say, well, these issues are very complex, and now let's dive into an understanding of them.
I would say, this is my depressing comment, if you weren't depressed by my Supreme Court rant, buckle in.
But I'm ready.
I think that one of the things that has alarmed me in the last few years, and this is on the left and the right in equal measure, is the sort of solipsism of, you and the press are not covering this, and this is important to me.
Mm-hmm.
You are covering this, which, right, is not important to me.
Right.
Therefore, the first thing is more important than the second thing, and you are lying, you know, as a, right. as a journalist. And there's an enormous amount of that, of sort of, and I don't mean to say solipsism. I regret using a word that suggests that everybody is just a narcissist living in their own world.
Is that what that word means?
Well, yeah, it does. That's exactly what it means. And it's a strong word, and I, you know, I'm hesitant to sort of say it out loud, but so much of my mail is, well, you wrote about this, but I'm worried about this. You're right. A bad journalist.
Well, how do we decide what is worthy of coverage and what isn't? And how do we decide it in the current world?
It's really hard because there's such here, you know, I am as much, you know, a contributor to this. You know, there's so much that is like right now we're talking about the Bundys. Let's all talk about the Bundys. You know,
right
now we're talking about Trump. Let's all talk about Trump. And there's a herd mentality. I mean, what I've found in my own reporting as a journalist is like now I'm just doing, you know, prison conditions and I'm just trying to find stories of people dying in prison with mental illness. And it never breaks through. Right. My dad reads it. So that's good. But I mean, no, it's never going to become, you know, the Bundy brothers.
Right.
But I think that there is going to be an obligation on the part of journalists to not write first impressions of stuff that just happened that everyone else is writing about. There's an obligation to do the opposite of that. But I will tell you, as a journalist, like that's where the traffic goes.
Right. And, well, that's where the money is.
That's where the money is.
And so the money drives the reporting.
Yeah.
The money drives the elections, and the money ultimately pretty much drives the country.
I think so. And I think, you know, it's very, very difficult to, you know, persuade an editor. Like, I have this really great story that 40 people are going to read, but it's important to me, when you could be the 50th person weighing in on what was the name of the guy? Ken, what was his name at the second debate in the red sweater?
Oh, yeah. Boney or Bone something.
Ken Bone. You know,
yeah.
I mean, how many thousand stories do we read about that guy? And that was the news.
It was a nice sweater.
And now I sound like the person I'm complaining about. Like, oh, my God, you're writing about Ken Bone instead of stuff that matters to me. But I do think that the herd, it's a little frightening.
Well, and yes, there is that herd mentality is put on steroids by social media.
Mm-hmm.
And there are pluses to that and minuses to that. One of the pluses to that is that the Dakota Access Pipeline protests can become bigger news because guess what? Somebody's out there talking about it.
Well, and Amy Goodman got herself arrested, which helps.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I heard about it before Amy Goodman got arrested, but I remember hearing that she got arrested and being kind of horrified, and she got acquitted. But then this week there were, 120, 140 people arrested?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also the problem of what is true. Right. You know, you see something on a feed like that on Facebook and you go, OK, well, so now let me check. Let me look at. And who do you check it with? Well, you Google it and you try to see if there's a reliable media outlet that has given some coverage to it. Right. And if there isn't, if you can't find something on the media, then you don't know if it's true or not.
And I want to tell you, this is the conversation I had this morning with my husband about the Jim Comey revelations is, you know, because we were trying to figure out really what are these
what
emails?
What happened? What is it really?
And I literally said the words, well, you know, the New York Times says it's a nothing burger and the, you know, Newsweek says it's a nothing burger and the Washington Post says it's a nothing burger. But I don't know. And now, you know, these are the papers of record.
Right.
And it's not because I think those papers are in the tank for Hillary. It's just that one comes to doubt when you Google anything.
Right.
What is really true. And I just think sort of as an existential matter, the fact that I even said the sentence, well, the New York Times says it's nothing, but who knows, you
right.
know, is really, really scary. And, you know, it really does. I think it just undergirds everything we've been saying here today about mistrust of institutions. You know, it used to be when Dan Rather told you something or Walter Cronkite said something or, you know, you looked in a paper, you really felt like this is, and I still do. I mean, I have to tell you, the thing that makes me crazy is when people say the mainstream media is all corrupt and they're
right,
all, you know,
right, right.
I'm not. I'm
right.
working really hard. But I do think that when you start to doubt things that are foundational to what you think truth is, you are in big, big, big trouble, because then you're really left with your two bubbles, you know, your two bubbles of truth that do not intersect in personal life. You know, we don't talk to each other. We don't interact with each other. We have our own media. And it's really unbelievable that the papers of record that you and I consider papers of record are now in the bubbles, too.
Right. Well, we do still talk to each other. Just in very small ways, we do. I mean, there's a group of guys that I have coffee with often at Starbucks over on 29. Hello, guys.
Hi, guys.
And some of those guys are very conservative. I remember having a argument with one of the fellas up there, you know, a few years ago, where his basic position was, well, civil unions are okay, but you shouldn't be able to get married. And my response was, you think I'm going to sit in the back of the bus? You know, you and the horse you rode in, right? You know, but we were talking to each other, right?
Yeah.
You know, and we, because those things didn't make us hate each other so much, we couldn't sit at the same table and drink a cup of coffee.
Mm-hmm.
I had a conversation this week with a good friend of mine who's a Republican. And we talked about Trump, and we talked about Hillary, and we talked about all of the bad things on both sides of that, and had a real conversation about it, where we were willing to admit to each other in the conversation, yes, here, you know, some of what you're saying is true. Some of what you're saying is legitimate. And yes, it does concern me. And I think that we can still, some of us can still have those conversations. And that's really our only hope, I think.
Well, and this goes back to, you know, I guess I would just say this again is why I love the courts, because I think it's a vehicle for talking to each other. And because, like, you know, every day you have encounters with people who you don't agree with and you work it out, you know, through fact and reason and persuasion and not, you know, screaming. But I also think this election for me has really been emblematic of how polarization has co-opted conversations. And so instead of talking about the, I believe there are 80% of the things, if we boil them down, that we agree on, we don't talk about those. We talk about almost exclusively about the furthest extremes. And, you know, here's my pitch for Merrick Garland. You know, what he's done for 20 years on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals is say, let's all get together on this. Let's find the one thing we agree on and work out from there.
Right.
That's how he does things. Now, that's why progressives think he's a big waffle.
Right.
It's why conservatives think he's a rabid bomb-throwing liberal.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that if you can't find a principled place of agreement, exactly what you're describing, let's start here.
Mm-hmm.
And that conversation is not happening, I think, in most of the media.
That conversation needs to be happening.
Amen.
It's hard to have that conversation in the public sphere, I think. It's easier to have that conversation in the private sphere. It's easier for me to sit down with my friend in a room with a cup of coffee and say, yeah, I know, than it is for somebody to stand up on TV. Because if you feel, we both, I think both sides feel like if you give the other side an inch, they'll take a mile and it's all over and you lost. That's kind of the feeling that I'm getting.
And yet McCain-Feingold, right? And yet the Senate over and over again has modeled that conversation. And you know, I loved what you said about juries. You know, jury is supposed to be sort of the passion, right? And the judges is the saucer that it cools off. And the Senate was meant to be, you know,
the saucer that it cools off. That's a great image.
And,
I like that.
And it's not mine. It's one of the framers. But I think that was one of, you know, that was always the idea. That's where things cool off. And I think what you've seen is this progression where there's no, you know, that was what the Senate modeled. And there's no reaching across the aisle anymore there either. And so then, you know, I think there are places in the public sphere where it can happen, but it requires such bravery now. It would require Ted Cruz to not shut down the government when he doesn't get what he likes.
Right.
And that's, I just think that
it does require bravery. That's exactly, it requires courage to do that. Courage and a belief in the institutional systems and the sort of idea that we will somehow arrive at the right place, even if I lose this battle. You know, we'll do what's right. And I think we have a hard time with that right now. I want to borrow a phrase from you earlier. You talked about a non-trivial possibility.
Mm-hmm.
I love that phrase. That's a great phrase. I feel like there is a non-trivial possibility that on November 9th, we're going to have some real civil unrest, that there are going to be, somebody is going to blow something up or shoot somebody, maybe several somebodies in different parts of the country. And I wonder, how do we retreat from that? How do we recover as a society?
So I, last week on my podcast, I actually asked this of White House counsel, Neil Edelstein. I was like, is this what worries you? Like, this is what worries me. You know, we've seen 8 years of, talk about nullification, you know, treatment of Obama as though he's not the president.
Right.
Not just by people who say he's, you know, the birthers, but by the Senate And how do we repair that when we hear, you know, folks coming forward saying if Hillary gets elected, the Republicans are going to commit themselves to, you know, not only investigating every time she sneezes, you know, what's in that tissue,
right?
But, you know, doing Benghazi, we're going to do Benghazi in the emails for the next 4 years. And that's, I mean, I think that's exactly what you're saying. Like, how do we knit this back together? And
not only that, I mean, I'm not talking about we're going to go through her emails and wonder what's in her tissue. I'm talking about somebody's going to get shot.
Yeah. I mean, so here's what, you know, I talked to someone from the Brennan Center who does all this work on voting this week. And she assured me that at the end of the day, they're not terrified that there's going to be, you know, civil unrest. And that's chiefly because her view was this is going to be a big win for Hillary Clinton. And, you know, we're not talking about hanging chads anymore.
Right.
We're talking about, you know, a rout. And because it's really hard to pick up your gun and, you know, jeopardize your job and your family and everything else for something that is factually not true. Now, I completely stipulate with you that it doesn't help when Donald Trump is saying, you know, get out there and watch the polls and make sure you have your gun. And, you know, if you go to Philadelphia, that's where they are. You know, this
right.
is not.
We might have a real problem on November 8th.
Yeah, no, this is not good. This is really fomenting, you know, and people talking about pitchforks and torches. None of that is helping.
Right.
And that's where I think you need the Paul Ryans of the world to be grownups. I actually think that's where you need, you know, Chief Justice John Roberts to be the grown-ups. But I don't disagree that we are, you know, kind of putting the ingredients together to have a big boom
right.
Of civil unrest. But I, you know, I sort of have to believe, and this is just the way I sleep through the night, is that if and when this is a decided victory, hopefully a lot of the people are just going to sort of say this isn't just not worth it. You know, this is not a close election. That's my hope. But I recognize what you're talking about. I mean, there's a lot of that talk out there.
I think we should all try to be grown-ups.
We should all try. Even, you know, my kids are now grown-ups in ways that, you know, just terrify me. And I sort of say it flippantly in that I think, you know, the language of if I said that at my school, you know, I'd get thrown out.
Right.
And that scares me. But also just the language of really having empathy. Which is gone from adult conversation, but kids really have it, I think.
Right.
And I just worry. I really worry when our kids are sort of more sophisticated in their understanding of what we need to do to get along, because that's what you do in the sixth grade.
Right.
We don't have that in the Senate. We don't have that in the House.
Well, so this is the moment where I say, thank you for coming on the show and talking to me
again. It was super fun.
It was super great to have you. You are listening to 94.7 WPVC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and you have been listening to Straight Talk, a local program dealing with law and social justice issues produced right here in Charlottesville by our very own Ben Chambers. And this program has been recorded on October 29th, and we hope that the world lasts long enough for it to be played, perhaps next weekend. So if there is a next weekend, you know, tune in. I'm Andre Hakes signing off for Straight Talk. Have a great weekend, y'all.